This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In, where we cover a handful of topics, not just one, although we will spend a good bit of our time today wrapping up the 2020 legislative session that came to a close this week. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the bills this year that had an environmental implication with the leader of the Hoosier Environmental Council. And later, we'll take an audio nature walk with the author of the new book, Heartland Habitats. But first, our wrap-up of the last week of the 2020 legislative session with Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Hi, Brandon.
Hey, last time this session for the show.
That's right. First things first, this is the top story around the world.
Yes.
Coronavirus. You just got done talking to Governor Holcomb, like literally just an hour or so ago.
Yeah, a little less than that, as a matter of fact.
What did he say?
Yeah, so he and State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box are doing a series of interviews with reporters today to talk about all of these issues. We, in our little gathering, we talked about the number of tests the state has or doesn't have, how many people they're testing daily, the sort of what the state is going to do on the economic impact that we will undoubtedly see from all of these shutdowns and the fall out from coronavirus coming here and everywhere in this country. We talked about are they getting the help from the federal government that they need? And let me give you some of the answers to those questions. First, we do not know how many Hoosiers are being tested. We know how many the state health department has tested, which is 73 as of right now. But there is private testing going on, and that isn't reported to the state. So Dr. Box just doesn't know. But we did learn from her that yesterday we heard that Ohio is estimating that roughly 1% of their population likely has the virus, even though there's not nearly enough testing to confirm that. Dr. Box said the same is probably true here. 1% of Indiana's population is roughly 66,000 people. So it's probable that roughly 66,000 people in Indiana have this virus. We know of 12.
Big difference.
Yes. But she did say that we aren't seeing the sort of serious situation that, for instance, Washington State has seen out on the West Coast. And we know that it's not as serious here in Indiana yet because we would see more serious cases in hospitals across the state. And she said we just don't see that impact. So we know that. We do know that. In terms of help from the federal government, Dr. Box and Governor Holcomb both say that they have gotten everything they've asked for so far from the feds, and that they know that they were going to continue to ask for more. That is unlike what we have heard in other states who are saying they're not getting equipment, they're not getting tests, they're not getting the Medicaid flexibility they need to address this problem. Here in Indiana, officials aren't saying that, although, of course, notably, not only are they of the same party, but the vice president is, of course, a Hoosier. And then on the idea of the economic impact, the governor is really big on this idea of what he calls flattening the curve, which is taking these immediate steps now, closing schools, asking folks not to gather in groups of 250 or more, things like that. You know, washing your hands really thoroughly. Don't go to work if you're sick. Cover your mouth when you cough or sneeze, things like that. He said people need to take these relatively smaller steps now to help spread out the inevitable impact of this virus. Lots of people have it. Lots of people will get it. We will almost certainly at some point see deaths from it. It's just inevitable. It is inevitable at this point. But the economic impact of people, you know, we're not going to theaters and restaurants and shopping. There are probably going to be layoffs from all of those things. But Governor Holcomb's hope is that if we take these steps now to sort of limit the spread and spread it out, the impact of this virus, the costs down the line, the long-term costs won't be as severe. But he said the state has $2 billion in reserves and will start to use it if and when it needs to.
What about action on school closures from the statewide level?
So the governors of Michigan and Ohio ordered all of their schools closed. Governor Holcomb did not. He gave schools flexibility to close but did not say that they should. And we asked him why not, and he said right now in consultation with health officials, they decided the best course of action was to give local schools that flexibility themselves. Mm. They can talk with their health officials. They can talk with the state and say, should we do this? But it's up to them to ultimately they make that decision for themselves based on the situation in their school district, in their communities. Holcomb did acknowledge that if the situation gets more critical, if we see more community spread, that could always change.
All right. Well, let's move on to the wrap of the session. And throughout this session, internally, and just talks that we've had off mic, you've said it's a weird one. And now
it's weird.
You,
I wrote a whole story about how it was weird.
And now, and the word weird is in the headline, so that's out in the open now. Why was it so weird?
The answer is there's a lot of reasons. The leadership changes. We saw the there's a new Senate president, Senate President Pro Tem. That was last session. So this was his second full session. But we're still – there's still a feeling out process there. The House changed speakers in the middle of this session. So even though there was an orderly transition there and the new speaker, Todd Houston, was learning alongside outgoing Speaker Brian Bosma the whole time, there was a sense among some that Bosma, you know, had a bit of senioritis. Certainly the last few days when he had actually stepped down, there was a lot of – I mean, he was literally walking around making snarky comments, joking.
Shirt was untouched.
Joking, yeah. No, joking with reporters, you know, just having some fun. But you could – it was like a senior on the day before graduation.
That must have been kind of fun for you.
It was fun for the reporters. I don't know how good it was for the process. But no, I mean – there was a lot of reasons. A short session that was made even shorter by some calendar things. A big election coming up always makes some folks a little more hesitant. But I talked to some lobbyists who were like, there's a disconnect between the leadership in the chambers and the committee level of the chambers, the committee chairs. And we hope that gets better, but that creates for a really disjointed process. And process does matter here because good laws are not made by a bad process.
Mm. Let's talk about some of the bills that are headed to the governor's desk. There are several. Let's just touch on a few. One of them being hands-free driving. He talked about this in State of the State address. He's expected to sign it. What did we ultimately get?
Yeah, credit to the governor here because there was a lot of hesitation among legislative leaders, Republican legislative leaders, to go forward on that. And then the governor really put out really urged lawmakers to do it privately as well as publicly. And I think it clearly worked because it sailed through the process after that. If you are holding your cell phone in your hand when you are driving, you are going to get or you can get a ticket. Mm. Now, an important change they made right at the end was in Indiana, you get points on your license for infractions. So if you're speeding, you get so many points. If you're speeding at a greater speed, you get so many points. If you run a stoplight, you get so many points. And the more points you rack up, your license could be suspended for a month, 2 months, and longer and longer and longer. For 1 year, so July 1st of 2020, this year, when the law takes effect to July 1st of next year, you aren't going to get points added for violating the hands-free driving law. That will eventually probably take effect. But for 1 year, it's just going to be the ticket and not potentially getting your license suspended if you have too many infractions.
And it can be a pretty hefty ticket.
It can. I think it's up to $500. Now, that's a range, so it's not automatically $500, but I believe that's the infraction level, yeah.
Okay. Just one abortion-related bill made it through this session, and this one deals with the handling of fetal remains. What are we talking about specifically?
This is a requirement, basically the procedures that healthcare facilities have to follow in order to either bury or cremate the fetal remains that they handle. Mm. So there are two types of abortions, surgical abortions, which are done in healthcare facilities. The healthcare facility has those fetal remains. They have to bury or cremate them. The other type is a medication-induced abortion where a woman takes a pill, or I think it's two pills. I think it's a two-stage thing. And that is typically done at home. The bill does not require the woman to do anything with the remains, the results of that medically or medication-induced abortion. Let me say that again. The woman doesn't have to do anything. Mm. And that's partly why there was a lot less controversy that kind of surrounded this bill this year as opposed to all of the abortion bills in years past.
Mm. We've got to hit this one. There was a bill that died this week, and that was good news for Attorney General Curtis Hill. What happened?
It sure was. So House Republicans late in session decided, listen, there's confusion about what happens if Curtis Hill, who's under a disciplinary investigation for groping allegations, if his license is suspended for any length of time, as a hearing officer has recommended, what happens to his ability to not only run for attorney general this year, as he's currently doing, but continue being attorney general this year? Mm. State law is not clear. House Republicans wanted to add that clarity. They would have said, if you get your license suspended for at least a month, you can't be attorney general. You can't run for attorney general. Senate Republicans said no. Now, publicly, they said, well, it's real close to an election. We don't want to interfere in that. Privately, I know that there were some who simply don't think Curtis Hill has done anything wrong.
The governor, Republicans in the House, including the new speaker, Todd Houston, all seem to want something like this bill to happen.
Yep.
And Houston even called the bill's failure the biggest missed opportunity of the session.
Yes, he did.
Why then did Senate Republicans kill this bill? What's the difference between the Republicans in the Senate and the Republicans in the House?
I wish I could tell you. I mean, there were some probably arm twisting in the House caucus over that bill. I would certainly suspect that. There were some Republicans who quite frankly voted against it. Not very many, but there were some. But there were enough in the Senate caucus clearly that they couldn't even bring it to the floor.
Of course, when it comes to talking about what was good and what was bad in the session, that depends on your party, depends on your perspective. What have you heard from lawmakers about how they feel about what did or didn't get done?
Republicans are largely happy. They're in the majority. Democrats are largely unhappy. They're in the minority. I will say that there is everybody agreed that we needed to do something about health care costs, about making them lower and more transparent this session. There's a little disagreement about whether we did that. Certainly we made them more transparent. We are going to have an all payer claims database where you're going to be able to go and look up, okay, this is how much I should expect to pay for this procedure in my area where I live. Maybe not to the individual hospital where you might want to go, but certainly in your area. So Indianapolis, Evansville, that sort of thing. But there were measures that, as originally written, would have ended surprise billing. So you go to get a procedure, your hospital's in network, the primary doctor is in network, all of that. All of a sudden, a few weeks later, you get a bill from an anesthesiologist who wasn't in network, and now you're paying thousands of dollars out of pocket because they weren't part of your network. Lawmakers wanted to end that. They didn't. What they said now, as the final bill was voted on and is expected to be signed by the governor, is they've got to tell you about that bill 5 days beforehand. You can say no. You could say no, but you wouldn't be saying no to the bill. You'd be saying no to the procedure. They're saying, well, then go shop around. If you can't pay that surprise bill, that it's no longer a surprise, we'll go shop around. I personally don't know how possible it is to shop around for healthcare at that level, but that's what the bill finally did. They're going to tell you about it. And you have to approve it in order to go forward with whatever the healthcare procedure is.
Brandon Smith is our Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter. Are you going to take any time off now that the session's over?
The idea of self-isolation is looking real appealing right now, so we'll see.
Thank you, Brandon. Brandon Smith also hosts the weekly political roundtable, Indiana Week in Review, which you can hear tonight at 6 on our flagship station, WFYI in Indianapolis, as well as WBAA in Greater Lafayette. And that show is on even when the session is not in session. Up next, more from the session. Can I say that word one more time? A closer look at a number of significant environmental bills with the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Let's dive a little deeper now into a few of this year's bills that could have the biggest impact on the environment here in Indiana. I'm joined by Jesse Carbonda. He's the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Hi, Jesse.
It's great to be with you, Matt.
As much as I'd like to build up to this one, I think we should start with it instead to make sure we cover it as best we can. This is the one that got perhaps the most attention, partially due to the nickname that it was given. We're talking about House Bill 1414, the so-called coal bailout bill, though coal is not mentioned by name in the language of the bill. In its current form, which was not the form that got so much attention when it was first brought to the floor, the current bill does not require utilities to keep coal plants open like it originally did. Big difference, lots of amendments between then and now, or maybe a few. Do you consider that part a win, the removal of that language?
Absolutely. And that shows, I think, the power of the public when they weigh in aggressively. And when various different stakeholders weigh in aggressively, that does result in impact. And I think that should be an encouraging signal to the public about the power that they have to influence things. But fundamentally, the basic concerns that we had about the bill, how this impacts rates, what this says about the reputation of Indiana, what this could signal to the clean energy marketplace remain.
But there were pragmatic reasons that were given for the bill. Do you buy any of those?
Well, you know, Matt, there were two premises of the bill that somehow it would help to ensure the reliability of electricity, and secondly, that it would help to soften the blow as coal mining communities are affected over time as we transition from coal to clean energy. But we had offered three recommendations that we thought would have a much more meaningful impact on addressing those two considerations, namely that rather than putting in place this new regulatory process that will slow down, particularly if the sunset date of this bill is removed, the transition from coal to clean energy, let's bring in people from places like Iowa, which is getting almost 40% of its electricity from renewable energy, and have them not only present before the energy task force that's in play, but also before the legislators in general, so that everyone is aware of the fact that you can reliably run electricity systems with very high levels of renewable energy. And we had also offered recommendations that we should increase the amount of appropriations in terms of job training by the state government to support coal miners and coal plant workers during the transition. Those recommendations were not heeded to. But in our view, that would have done a better job addressing the premises of the bill than the bill itself.
It seems, though, like one of the main reasons for the bill was to give the 21st Century Energy Task Force time to finish what they started.
That's in concept, that is right. But the problem is that right now the bill has a sunset date where the things that bothered the opponents of the bill, that ends in May of 2021. But the problem is that the Indiana General Assembly has in the past either pushed back those sunset dates or removed them altogether. And all of a sudden, if those things happen, they will have an impact on the pace with which we transition from coal to clean energy. And we worry about the job implications of that. We worry about the investment implications of that. We worry about how this might impact electricity rates. That's where our fundamental concern is.
Let's talk about those jobs. There's also that part about the people working in the coal industry. It's a tough time for them. They're seeing their jobs coming to an end. In some cases, it's the only work they've ever known. And some might say that this bill, 1414, extends some compassion to them in the form of priority on workforce training grants that could help get them jobs in other fields. If the governor vetoes it like you want him to, wouldn't we lose that part too?
Well, we would actually call on the governor to issue an executive order to say, look, we want the job training grants that are under the discretion of the Indiana state government to be prioritized to these displaced workers. I think that's the way to solve the issue. You know, inevitably, with complicated bills, there are going to be components that one likes, and then there are going to be components that one does not like. And the problem is this bill does more harm than good.
Another controversial one is Senate Bill 229. This allows local governments to fix or reconstruct drains in wetland areas without a permit from IDEM, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. It underwent two amendments before it was passed. What were those?
One amendment, Matt, was if in the context of reconstruction of a drain, the reconstruction has to happen within the easement of the drain. And that is an improvement over the original bill. But we really need to unpack what reconstruction means. It's a far-reaching activity that can be quite destructive to wetlands. Why? Because reconstruction could entail enlarging a drain, extending a drain, rerouting a drain, changing a system from a physical drain to basically a pit. All these things are land-altering activities. And if a surveyor isn't being really careful, that could result in the damage of wetlands. And the problem is that we have lost 85% of our wetlands over the life of the state of Indiana. And we were once 25% covered by wetlands, and again, just a few percent right now. And these wetlands are so critical to reducing flooding risks, to purifying our waters, and of course, being an incredible habitat, the most important habitat for birds. So we think this is an imprudent piece of public policy, although it has been somewhat mitigated by these two amendments.
Your organization, the Hoosier Environmental Council, pushed for those amendments Why do you still want the governor to veto it?
Well, we called really consistently throughout the legislative process for no bill, because the thing is, the existing policy allows for reconstruction of these drains to take place. It just has to happen through a permitting process. And if it happens through a permitted process, what it means is that a surveyor will do everything he or she possibly can to preserve the wetland. And to the extent that it has some part of it has to be impacted or harmed or destroyed, then one has to, under the permit, offset, more than offset, the damage that happens. So the current process is good. And because the current process is superior to any version of the bill, we consistently called for the bill to die.
The argument for this bill is that by cutting the permit requirement, it streamlines the process so that local governments can work on their own drains whenever they feel they need to. So it allows for more control locally, which lowers costs drastically. Is that too much control, though, in your view?
Well, Matt, we would actually say that the irony of this, if this does become law, is it probably will prolong these projects. And why that's the case is that if SB 229 becomes law, you're essentially creating a discrepancy between state law and federal law. And you're basically saying, well, you're subject to one set of requirements if you're governed by the state and another set of requirements if you're governed by federal law. And the problem is that if a surveyor is going to pursue reconstruction of a drain, he or she would need to determine whether that wetland that would be impacted is subject to state or federal law. And that is a determination that can only be made by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And of course, they've got limited staff. So it's going to take time for the Corps to assess whether it is federal or state jurisdiction. That's going to prolong the process.
Okay, moving on to House Bill 1385. This protects public access to Lake Michigan. It's headed to the governor. Let's get into some detail, though. What would this one do?
Well, in 2018, there was a important and welcome decision made by the Indiana Supreme Court that enshrined into precedent public access to the Lake Michigan shoreline. And what 1385 does is it enshrines it into statute. So this is something that we very warmly support. And furthermore, it would make it unambiguous that the public has the right to walk along the shoreline, to boat and fish in Lake Michigan, and to swim in Lake Michigan, and to do other recreational activities as deemed appropriate by the Natural Resources Commission. So these are wonderful developments in terms of ensuring kind of a consistency that one has access to the Lake Michigan shoreline. Of course, it unambiguously states that the shoreline is owned by the state of Indiana, which was something quite contended by a small set of private landowners in Northwest Indiana.
And the decision that was made there was that they own the land up to the high water mark.
That's right.
And then everything beyond that is public.
That's right. From the edge of the water to the ordinary high water mark, that shoreline is owned by the state of Indiana.
Getting back to House Bill 1385, Senator Karen Tallien, a Democrat, represents a good bit of some of the problem areas up north along the shore. And she said she's pleased with the bill. We had her on the show earlier this week to address the erosion problem along the lakeshore. And this bill allows homeowners to construct or repair seawalls. And there's concern that that could further erosion on either side of the seawalls. What's the Hoosier Environmental Council's stance on that?
You know, all I can speak to on that, Matt, is that our understanding was that one of the concerns on the part of the private landowners was that some of the local governments were kind of dragging their feet about whether a private landowner could pursue a seawall reconstruction, seawall repair, and so this sets a clock, I think, of 10 or 15 days for which a local government has to act. And I don't know what the repercussions of the reconstruction of the seawall are on the erosion problem, which I know is a serious issue up there.
Fair enough. House Bill 1265 requires schools to test for lead in their drinking water. It's the first bill of its kind. How was Hoosier Environmental Council involved here?
We were consistently involved through the process. In fact, Hoosier Environmental Council has for several years really tried to help elevate the problem of lead poisoning. And our environmental health director, Dr. Indra Frank, has been very involved in lead issues for many years as a public health expert. And basically, the bill is a very positive step in that it deals with one of the major sources of lead exposure for kids, which is that it could happen through drinking water. You know, other sources, of course, are through paint is probably the number two risk to kids. And this requires that any school that hasn't tested for lead since 2016 has to test for lead by 2023. All across the state. And one of the important contributions that our organization helped to make to this effort was the bill started off being specific to Lake County, and we called for that it be statewide. And of course, much credit to Representative Jackson from Northwest Indiana, who led the effort legislatively there.
This bill sets a lead threshold of 15 parts per billion before action is required on the part of the school. But according to some reporting done by our Indiana Public Broadcasting team, even that isn't enough. Bottled water isn't allowed to be any more than 5 parts per billion. Senator Mark Stoops tried to amend the bill to make that the threshold instead of 15 parts per billion, but it failed. Is this bill as good as we can expect at this time?
Well, it's a step. And, you know, we share the view that the threshold has to be lower to be in conformity with the science. And, EPA says it ought to be 0 parts per billion as far as what is good for health. The American Academy of Pediatrics says it should be 1 parts per billion. So we should let science drive this, and we would definitely support a lower threshold. But the fact that you now have in statute this requirement is a milestone. And we will be, alongside others, alongside academics who've brought up this issue, we will definitely be pushing for a lower threshold in revisits to this bill.
Purdue professor Andrew Welton told one of our reporters that no amount of lead is considered safe. Would that be a reasonable goal in the future with this older infrastructure?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's nothing that would prevent a school from pursuing that kind of aggressive action. The fact that they're now required to do the testing means that they will shed to light to their stakeholders, to parents, to kids, to faculty, to staff, that, look, this is the state of lead in our system. And our thinking is that a wise, science-driven administration of a school would say, look, you know, let's act not just to protect those kids who are getting exposed to levels above 15 parts per billion, but well below it, 20. So that is not precluded for these schools doing.
House Bill 1279 would have facilitated transit development. It died in the 11th hour?
That's right. Yes, this was really astonishing that you had a bill that had to do with Northwest Indiana development issues. And all of a sudden, there is an amendment offered in the Senate to HB 1279. So, Matt, what this amendment would have done is two things. It would have stated that Indigo would have to raise 10% of its operating expenses through private funds. And if it didn't, then A, that 10% of the local transit tax could be withheld by the state, and B, Indigo would not be able to move forward with its expansion. Its system upgrades that they're going to unveil in the next month or so, and then, of course, the blue and the purple lines. And that would, of course, been devastating to efforts to try to really modernize our transit system in Indianapolis.
Okay, let's move on to Senate Bill 46. This would have slashed available revenue of local stormwater professionals. And what does this bill look like now?
Well, the original context of the bill would have been to enable schools and places of worship to no longer have to pay stormwater fees. And the problem is that schools and places of worship share some things in common when it comes to stormwater, which is they have very big parking lots and they have lots of roof. And both those things mean that they can be major sources of stormwater runoff. And this is an enormous problem in our state. In fact, in Marion County alone, we generate about 87 billion gallons per year of stormwater pollution. And so therefore, all the impacts that we're making, positive impacts we're making through the Dig Indy project, multi-billion dollar project that is reducing sewage runoff into our waterways, we still are not addressing this big behemoth of stormwater. And thankfully, this bill in its original form died and again would have cut funding for important efforts we need to undertake to address stormwater pollution in our communities. It has now been converted into a study committee, which often happens to controversial bills. And now they're going to look into what is the implication, I think in part the revenue implication of cutting funding that would have been attributed to schools and places of worship. Furthermore, we would like it, this study committee, to really dig into how this would impact stormwater pollution, given the effort on the part of communities all across Indiana to try to tackle an issue with a sensitivity towards the fact that we really need to revitalize our rivers, not just from an ecological perspective, or but also from the standpoint that communities that really put a lot more emphasis on green amenities are more likely to retrain and attract great talent.
Jesse Carbonda is Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Jesse, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Matt.
Up next, as we look towards spring next week, a new Midwestern guide to some of the most common nature outside our windows. Author Mary Bloxma shares her book, Heartland Habitats, with us in just 90 seconds from now. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're just 1 week away from the official start of spring, which means more outdoor time. If you're a person who enjoys visiting our many state parks, state forests, and nature preserves, this segment's for you. I'm a hiker who only sometimes stops to smell the roses, so to speak, take in the scenery, the flora, the fauna, but it's because I don't know what a lot of it is to begin with. Well, one Midwestern writer who knew just as much as I did, that is not a lot, sought to learn about the many things she's seen outside and ended up with a beautiful, very accessible book, and it has just come out. Heartland Habitats, 265 Midwest Nature Walks. Author Mary Bloxma joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Matt.
So when I first ran across this, I thought, not another trail guide. We've got trail guides. And then I opened it up and it's not. This is not about the places you can visit. It's about what you can see on nearly any given Midwestern nature walk.
Yes, it's a memoir. It's not a guide. It's a story of a year when I decided that I would take 4 or 5 walks a week. And each time I would identify something, so that by the end of the year, I would kind of know what was what in nature. And it happened. It really works. I was intimidated by all that green for so long, and I was determined to make friends with it.
What was the spark? I'm picturing a moment like countless moments I've had where I've stopped on a hike, and I've looked at something, and I wondered what it might be, but then I did what I always do. I just walked off and forgot about it. Is that what happened to you, but you just couldn't shake it?
No, I had moved from California to the house on Lake Michigan, and I just needed to get out of a depression. I needed to distract myself with a plan, and this was my antidepressant to start this walk, but I really got into it, and I got so excited about it, and my editor did as well, so I spent the year doing these walks.
And like a lot of things, I'm sure you started with some of the most immediate things. What did you start with? What did you first look at?
Well, I've loved nature all my life. I've gone for walks. I've grown up in the woods and in various times in my life. But I really just didn't know anything except big, loud birds, cardinals and blue jays and crows. And that was about it. So when I moved to this place, it had a balcony, and I hung up a bird feeder. It took me a while to get the right bird feeder, and I write about that, and the right bird feed, and I write about that. But I finally learned a bird, and I think the first bird I learned was a titmouse, which is the cutest thing. It's got a little perky head, little top knot and black button eyes, and it's gray, and it's not very big, and it's just the cutest thing. And I was so thrilled when I learned that titmouse. And then it took quite a while for birds to come to my feeder, and I almost gave up. And then the house finch came, and then the woodpeckers came, and then the crows came, and then the raccoons came. And so to start with, I was bringing some nature to me.
What about other animals? Did you see anything that you later found out was particularly rare or elusive?
Well, yeah, of course, because if what I learned was 90% of success is showing up. And if you show up often enough in nature, you will see things. I mean, things just happen. I never heard of deer bark, for example. I was out one time, hadn't seen anybody, and I startled a deer, and the deer startled me, but he barked. And I didn't know deer could bark. I've never seen them make any kind of sound at all, except the sound of their hooves. And so that was pretty startling. And that same day, I watched a pair of pileated woodpeckers. And I was so thrilled to identify one. I couldn't believe I was seeing a pileated woodpecker. And sure enough, a mate came along. And there were two of them flying around me for 20, 30 minutes. I just sat on this log and they just flew around me in full sight. I didn't even need binoculars to see them. It was so thrilling. Things like that do happen if you go out there long enough, often enough.
Did you find yourself feeling like you had to be still in order for this wildlife to come to you? Or were you just carrying on as if this were any other day and you were just on a walk?
Oh, I just go on a walk.
Yeah, yeah. And got lucky.
Well, you know, a lot of things don't care if you're noisy. Trees and wildflowers and mushrooms, and you can stalk the wild asparagus. I did that for a while, actually, when I was in my 20s. In the Rocky Mountains, I got into wildflowers and also hunting edible wild things.
What about some of those plants? What are some common Midwestern foliage that maybe not everybody could identify?
Oh, listen, it's good to start with the easy stuff. That's what I did.
Okay.
And I decided, oh, yes, because when it comes to trees, it's just so intimidating. I mean, there's just too much green, and they're so high up there, and who can tell anything from bark and tree shape and all that. I mean, it just drove me nuts. So I started with some easy leaves, and one is sassafras leaves. You could tell a sassafras from distinctive leaves. One is mitten-shaped, one is goose-shaped, and one is just oval. And they have these three different shapes of leaves, and they're big, and they're really obvious. And sassafras is a real common kind of, it's between a shrub and a tree. Another thing I did, there's three easy tree barks too, but they're not all that common. White birch, for example, paper birch. People know about that peeling bark that's so famous for being made into things.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's very beautiful. There's also a yellow birch that has peely bark too, but it's kind of yellowish and curly. Doesn't come off in big sheets like that. I point out a lot of things in here to look at. If you really want to know trees, you have to look closely. And there are easy things to help tell them. I've written a children's book called What's in the Woods. And in it, I have a section on how to tell the evergreens apart for kids. And adults don't know that stuff. And you look at how long the needles are. Are they in bunches or do they grow along the stem? Are they flat or are they round? And then you can tell a lot of things from that.
Did you find at the end of this year that you could go out and identify just about any tree that you looked at? That's a skill that I would like to help, that I would like to develop myself.
Well, no, I can't identify just anything, especially in winter. It's harder for me. for anybody, but there are other things to look for in winter. And yeah, I can identify a lot of trees. I kind of like identifying things at 45 miles an hour going down the road, you know. Oh, I know what that, like a Norway spruce has branches that are like arms reaching for a hug. You know, they're curved up on both sides. And there's not any other tree I've ever seen, especially an evergreen tree, that has branches like that. So I can spot one of those. But it took me possibly 3 months to figure that out from the tree across the road from me was a Norway spruce. But I can't identify just anything. But most things feel, I can do enough of them that it feels comfortable for me in the woods now.
I am particularly fascinated by mushrooms when I come across them. And it seems like, looking through this book, that you might be as well. There are a lot of mushrooms in this book.
Well, here's the deal. When I finished this book, I finally started noticing mushrooms. I did this whole book. I went through the whole year, and I really didn't see any mushrooms until Shaggy Manes near the end in November, when it was a real late mushroom, and they're real, you can't miss them. They were all along the road like soldiers, little white shaggy soldiers along the road where I was living. And I was just astonished, and actually they were so distinctive that I was able to identify them without much help from guides, which is unusual for mushrooms. Usually it takes me several guides to identify a mushroom, if I can even do it then. But at the end of this book, I finally got really interested in mushrooms, and I thought, well, my next book, I think I'll do mushrooms. So I started looking for mushrooms and interviewing people and going on hikes with mushroom clubs and going all over the place learning mushrooms. But, you know, people used to say to me, oh, I've only been doing this for 20 years. I don't really know enough to write a book. And I've been doing it for 25 years now, and I finally know enough to write a little bit of a book. I can't write a guide to mushrooms by any means, but what I can write about and did in this book at the beginning of every month, this is you read through the book January through December, and at the beginning of each month I have the mushrooms that I learned that you might find in that month.
Mushrooms can be a real rabbit hole to go down. And it can also be, if you're talking about like foraging and things like that, that can be a dangerous rabbit hole as well if you don't know what you're doing. Was that top of mind when you were writing about mushrooms?
Oh, well, sure. I love eating mushrooms. And so I really wanted to learn how to identify them and not die.
You
know?
Yeah.
So the mushroom hunters all know the expression. There are old mushroom hunters and bold mushroom hunters, but no old bold mushroom hunters.
Oof. Yikes. Well, I'm not much of a mushroom hunter, but I know people who really get into it. Is it morel season yet?
It's probably getting to be morel season where you are. You know, when I tell people that I hunt mushrooms, they immediately think I hunt morels. But I'm really bad at hunting morels. I have a really hard time finding them. And in the spring, there just aren't too many other kinds of mushrooms out there. There's oyster mushrooms happening on aspen trees in certain places. But I'm kind of bored by the mushroom hunter thing. I really like the fall, late summer and fall, when there's all kinds of boletes and all kinds of other mushrooms, just gazillion other mushrooms that are so beautiful and interesting. So you're much more likely to find mushrooms in the late summer and fall than in the spring.
And so what you're talking about really isn't finding mushrooms for food. You're just finding them to look at them and appreciate them. And there are
well both. I do hunt for food, and I have my territories, and I'm like these fishermen that won't tell you where their fishing holes are. Mushroom hunters will not tell you where their spots are, and I will not tell you either.
Sometimes nature can be exciting. We're talking about wild places, after all. Did you see anything particularly dramatic?
Well, I had an encounter with a wild swan. I was out with a photographer friend of mine, and we were in a wetlands, and there was we were across some water, not too much, maybe 100 feet, from a huge, huge swan's nest, and we I guess we were far enough away that we couldn't tell what all the dots were on that nest. It was so odd. And then the swan shifted and these dots all moved, and they were painted turtles all over the sunning themselves on the swan's nest. And so we were about to go and get a camera to take pictures of all this when all of a sudden one of the swans came after us.
After you?
After my friend. He was waiting out to take a picture. And it was really crazy. It was really aggressive, this swan. But anyway, a goose came along and distracted the swan, and so we escaped. But it was and I've been attacked by an osprey.
Oh my gosh.
On a path that I used to take, and then one day I was attacked by this osprey. And I had a really big Outback hat that was denim, and I was really glad I had it because I could wave it at them, and I ran. I mean, he chased me. I thought he's got his claws out. That's a sea eagle, you know, another name for the osprey. You see them around water, and they're really fun to watch because they're just gorgeous to watch because they dive bomb the water to come up with fish, and you can see them flying with this fish in their talons. Well, that was one of my adventures.
Was there anything that you saw that you didn't like? Invasive species or examples of detrimental human impact?
Oh, of course. Yeah, there's a lot of invasive species. One of them is knotweed. Knotweed has got a real hard, round bottom and then a pink tufts coming out of it. It's poofy. They have very rough stems, and they grow all over the place, and it's an invasive species and not good. People are trying to get rid of that, but it just, these invasive species really take over, and they're really hard to get rid of.
I feel like every few times I go out, I find something new to appreciate if I'm really taking it all in, which again I don't do all the time, admittedly. Did this project give you any new appreciation?
Oh, you know, of course it did. I mean, I saw new stuff all the time, and the fun was every time I went out, I get to choose anything I wanted to study, anything that just caught my eye. And so I did birds and wildflowers, and it just made it so much fun. I had to buy a lot of guidebooks as I went along. But, you know, you can also use a computer. There's some wonderful stuff on the computer, online, on YouTube. You can get guides to almost anything on YouTube, I discovered. So I did a lot of online learning, too, as I went along in my research. And you can find guides to your own location as well.
Mary Bloxma is the author of the new book, Heartland Habitats, 265 Midwest Nature Walks, out now from IU Press. Mary, how can we find more from you?
Oh, you can go to my website, marybloxma.com.
Mary, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Subscribe so you always know what we're up to. And if you missed Wednesday's episode on the coronavirus pandemic, we got a great Indiana perspective from an epidemiologist and a physician who was part of the team that handled the first official case in Indiana. That episode was full of useful information, and we've been hearing a lot of good things from people who learned a lot listening to it. You can find that in our podcast feed. In the meantime, we are on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Have a great weekend and keep your hands clean. This is All In.